Good afternoon to Professor Anthony Staines. Many people have been waiting for the 22nd of October. They have been led to believe that it will be Ireland's Freedom Day. We get that name from our neighbours across the water, and their Freedom Day didn't work out, and it looks as if our Freedom Day will not either. Anthony, today the Professor of Immunology at DCU, Christine Loscher, a colleague of yours, did say that she believes society can reopen further and this spike in cases isn't unexpected. 2,066 cases of the virus were reported yesterday. Can we reopen, Anthony?
I think with great care we can reopen parts of what we want to do, but I don't think the rhetoric and language around Freedom Day was helpful in the United Kingdom, and I don't think it's terribly helpful here. This is a novel endemic respiratory virus, and we've made a decision we're going to allow it to continue to circulate in our society. And that's going to have effects which run out for many years. Just as HIV, for example, when it arrived in Ireland, changed people's sexual behaviour really to the present day. Having COVID-19 circulating in a society is going to change how people behave to an extent, regardless of what the government say, regardless of what the government do. People are going to make their own assessment of the risks from their point of view. They're going to look at the potential severity of this disease. It's a very nasty illness. It's not like flu, and flu itself is pretty unpleasant, but this is considerably more unpleasant. And they're going to weigh up the risks to themselves, the risks to their families, and choose what to do themselves. And I think we need to acknowledge that and support people in reducing risks as far as possible.
Anthony, you said that as a country, and maybe you meant in terms of the government, we've decided to live with this virus. Many people in the country would absolutely love, I'm sure, to be honest, I'm sure the majority would absolutely love for this island to be zero COVID. And I know yourselves at the ISAG have been advocating for that. But over the past few weeks, when we heard of New Zealand and Australia both not admitting defeat, because that takes away the great effort they have made and success they have made of the virus impacting their countries, but they have kind of come to terms with the fact that it looks as if the virus will circulate in their society also. And many people in other countries where the virus has been circulating has said that we all knew this from day one. Why was there an advocacy for zero COVID when it's basically impossible to control a virus? What would you say to people who argue that in terms of this upcoming 22nd of October hashtag Freedom Day?
I'd say two things. If you look at the economic impact, the impact in terms of dead people, the impact in terms of serious illness, both Australia and New Zealand have done much better than most European countries. And we had always said from the very beginning of this that vaccines were going to be an extraordinarily important part of our way out. And the trick was to keep case numbers down as low as possible while you waited for vaccination to become available, and then use whatever measures were necessary with vaccination to continue to control cases. There are vaccines, and measles is the most famous example. Measles vaccination effectively eliminates measles, and that seems to work everywhere it's been tried. Other viruses, it's harder to seriously suppress, but we have suppressed polio almost globally. We've suppressed rinderpest, which is a disastrous animal virus all over Africa. It's now extinct. We can suppress COVID if that's what we want to do. We did suppress SARS-1. SARS-1 is no more. And we've managed to keep control over MERS, which is the other new coronavirus that emerged in the last 20 years. And that still occurs, but it's largely controlled in the Arabian Peninsula.
So what about a member of NEFA today, Dr. Mary Favier, coming out and saying that we need to protect the hospital system? That's what we heard from day one of the pandemic being declared, even before this country was put into lockdown. It was about protecting the hospital systems in our countries and globally, obviously. And Dr. Mary Favier did say that there is quite an increase and a ripple of anxiety and fear within the healthcare service at the moment.
Yeah, the health service is under severe stress because of COVID. Now, we always have severe stress in winters for a whole bunch of reasons, but COVID makes that much, much worse. And we've seen the soaring waiting lists. We've seen, I think, a third of people in intensive care at the moment are there because of COVID, 80 out of 350-odd. That's very, very worrying if you're in the space. What's not quite so visible is the burden of COVID on schools and education. I'm speaking to teachers where there are scores of children out of school who are unwell who are isolating. We're seeing the same thing in third level. You know, numbers of students from every class are away at any given time. They might be being tested, they might be in isolation, they might be sick. It varies greatly. And we're seeing this across all of society. And we're also seeing the long-term effects of this virus. So what we would suggest is that we try to suppress case numbers as far as we can. And, you know, we know what to do. This is routine public health measures, just done at an appropriate scale. If those measures are very successful, you drive the virus down to zero. And if they're less successful, you get substantial suppression of cases. But suppression of cases is still a win. If there's very few people getting infected, there's very few people will end up in hospital. There's very few people who get seriously ill. There's no upside to large numbers of people being infected.
You mentioned the AIDS epidemic. I myself, I wasn't alive then. Myself and others who were in our 20s and younger, obviously. What are we to expect living in, at the moment we know it's a pandemic, but it probably will, I believe, stay that way for the next year at least. Am I right in saying that? The declaration will still be there?
Yeah, I think that's likely to happen.
So what should we expect to see? Because globally, we have made a decision as a globe, really, that this virus is going to circulate.
It means taking precautions in crowded spaces. It means improving ventilation. Now, you know, improving ventilation is not a bad thing. Spending more time out of doors is not a bad thing. Having more of an outdoor recreation, outdoor dining, outdoor entertainment culture is not a bad thing. You know, there are benefits to all of this, and we can see some of the benefits. But the people will be reluctant to go into crowded, poorly ventilated indoor spaces. And that has implications for the business model, particularly in hospitality and entertainment. It means, you know, in the old word from the theatre, it means fewer bums on seats.
I think people from that sector are wary of yourselves and at the ISAG and others because they kind of see you guys as the big bad wolf. And we do know that sector really has been the one that's been hardest hit. And I know you know that, and I know all your peers 100% know that. Yeah. But you're talking about, you know, a change in culture. A change in culture, unfortunately, does take years. We can look at anything that we're trying to change. It's Black Lives Matter movement, or it's, you know, women becoming equal to men, or it's racism as a whole. It hasn't changed in so many aspects, and something like this culturally is going to take a while to change. So within that period, does that mean that that sector is going to potentially suffer even more and for longer? Because on the 22nd of October, lots of musicians have come forward and said, if things don't get back to normal, we're going to be absolutely decimated.
And I absolutely sympathise with that. And it's partly been our government's choice to have continued lockdown. If you speak to musicians in Australia and New Zealand, they've been largely in business for most of the last 19, 20 months. Now, there have been periods when they haven't. And you know, the disruption they've had is real, but it's been much less severe than the disruption we've had here. So it's a mistake to think the only alternatives are complete freedom and, you know, everyone confined 2 kilometres from their house and everything closed. Those are not the options. The lockdown is a sensible, immediate emergency response. It makes sense for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, to at the start of a pandemic, just to get things under control. But after that, if you have to bring in a global lockdown or a countrywide lockdown, it's essentially saying you've failed to control infection.
Anthony,
we have failed.
If you were a betting man, how long would you say this pandemic declaration will stay in place?
I'd say it'll be another 18 months to 2 years if we do get rapid spread of vaccines around the country, around the world. If we don't, it could take longer than that.
OK, well, Professor Anthony Staines, Professor of Health Systems at the School of Nursing and Psychotherapy and Community Health at DCU. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you very much. Nice talking with you.
Colour blindness affects somewhere in the region of between 1 in 8 and 1 in 12 men and 1 in 200 women. So it's a fairly prevalent colour perception difference throughout society. But what is it like to be colour blind? Writing on this matter, I'm joined on the line by Joel Walmsley of the Department of Philosophy at UCC. Joel, you're welcome to the programme.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
We're delighted to have you. You are colourblind.
That's right. Yeah, I am. I have a form of red-green colourblindness called deuteranomaly, to give it its Latin or its Greek name, rather.
And I think a lot of people, when you hear colourblindness, assume that it's a monolith and that everybody who lives with colour perception difference sees in grayscale. But it's as varied a spectrum of experience, really, as any other way of being.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are some people who sort of see the world monochromatically. They're very rare. For most people, it's one of the three main colours where there's a slight defect, right? So we've all got three types of colour receptor cells, cones in our eyes, red, green and blue. And so depending on which of those receptor cells is affected, that will affect the way in which your brain puts together the colours that you actually perceive.
And I would imagine, and I have no data to hand to back this up, just as this is just purely anecdotal, there is a form of colour blindness which makes differentiating between hues a little more different than people who don't have that experience may find it. And I'm going to guess that that's quite prevalent. I know so many people who cannot differentiate between colours that are tonally similar, let's say bronze and gold, for example, and not all of that is attributable to perhaps a deficiency in colour language.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, colour vision deficiency, as you said in your introduction there, it affects about 1 in 12 men and about 1 in 200 women. By way of example, I teach a big first-year philosophy course here in UCC, and so I have about 300 students, and I teach a little bit about perception. And every year amongst those 300 students, I generally have about a dozen people with a form of colour vision deficiency. And more importantly, every year I always have one or two people who didn't already know that that was how the world appeared to them. So, you know, they find out for the first time in my lectures. So I think it's a lot more prevalent than people often realise.
And dependent upon, I suppose, your choice of vocation throughout life, you could conceivably live your entire life not knowing that you had a form of colour blindness because your reality doesn't differ from the reality you've already experienced, and there's no way to compare colour experiences between people in a real quantitative way.
Yeah, that's right. So that's what brings my professional interest to bear on it, as it were. I mean, this is a notorious problem in philosophy of mind, the difficulty of describing accurately one's subjective experience, as it were. But practically speaking, you're right that it does rule out certain career paths for people if they find out when they're young. In my own case, I found out that I was red-green colorblind when I was about 6 or 7. It used to be routinely screened in primary schools where I grew up in the UK. Mm. And I was told at the time, you can't be a pilot and you can't be an electrician. So I was fortunate in the sense that I didn't realize that, so I never formed any grand aspirations to fly planes or anything like that. But I still ask my family to double check when I rewire a plug. so certain occupations are definitely ruled out and or made difficult if you don't already know that that's a problem for you.
That reminds me of the scene. I don't know if you've seen Little Sunshine of the Spotless Mind or the Little Miss Sunshine with Steve Carell and Toni Collette. And one of the characters in it had wanted for his entire life to be a pilot and only realised, I think, when he was about 18 that he had red-green colourblindness and couldn't do it. That must be devastating if you find yourself in that situation.
That's right. And I mean, that's, of course, one of the important reasons for sort of trying to have some early screening, not only to sort of help kids overcome it so that they can sort of have the right kinds of expectations, but also so that when people get that far down the line, it doesn't end up in problems like causing accidents or running stoplights and that sort of thing as well.
And I think we should probably pause at this point to note how much of our lives are lived in colour, how many road signs, how many social site cues are colour based. And I'm not just talking about stop signs or traffic lights. Sport is bathed in colour. The arts are bathed in colour. And if these are areas of life in which you want to engage as an active participant, unless there are perhaps design changes or accommodations or complete reworking or reform, you might find that you're excluded.
That's right. I mean, I follow Cork City. And so, you know, when Cork City play St Pat's or against Cove, it's always difficult for me to tell which team is which. That's you know, not the end of the world for me. I find ways of coping. But you can easily imagine situations where it becomes much more difficult. Right? The Lewis map is in green and red, so that can be difficult. You know, Christmas is coming up, so you might sit around with your box of sweets. And I really like the strawberry ones, and my wife really likes the hazelnut ones. And so if I end up eating what I think is a red sweet, but it's actually a green one, or if I had a nut allergy, then it would become really serious, right? So the more that people become aware of this, the more situations I think they see in which this could really be a problem. So I've had, you know, people say, oh, I didn't really realize that these kinds of things, you know, could affect people with a color vision deficiency. But at the same time, I think accommodating them can sometimes be pretty straightforward, low-cost ways of doing it, right? So the Lewis map also has labels for the names of the stops. So, you know, the chance of me confusing it on the basis of color alone isn't too bad. And the same is true for Christmas sweets or crayons and that sort of thing. If we find ways of making very simple accommodations, it can be much, much easier for people with forms of colour blindness to cope.
Arguably, they aren't even accommodations. It's a slight reform and greater clarity of design.
I think that's right, yeah. So, I mean, to go back to the sports kit examples, right, you may have seen that famously recently World Rugby have decreed a new regulation to prevent kit clashes, which would affect Ireland versus Wales, for example, in particular. But in some cases, at least for me, and obviously I can't speak for everyone with different forms of colour vision deficiency, but for me, when I'm watching a sports match, if the teams have different coloured shorts on, that's okay. You know, if they've got red and green jerseys, but one of them also wears red shorts and the other wears white shorts, that's not so bad. I can manage that. So these kinds of small changes that aren't too drastic are often really straightforward.
And I would imagine if you drive that you're relying on the sequence of the lights rather than the colour of the traffic lights to decide whether to stop, go or get ready to stop.
Well, I mean, that's one reason why the lights are always positioned in the same way. But for me, at least, and I think this is true for many other individuals with a form of colour blindness, it's less of a problem when it's the light source that's coloured. So lights themselves aren't as much of a problem as things that are reflecting light, right? So, you know, coloured shirts or sweet wrappers or electrical wires. So it doesn't generally present as much of a problem, for me at least, when it comes to traffic lights, because they're the source of the light. But sometimes, you know, in those cases, if it's an unusual situation or it's a light that's not particularly bright, or if it's in the corner of my, you know, in the corner of my vision and I'm not particularly paying attention, that's when things can become a problem.
Have you ever tried what those seemingly magical glasses that give people with some forms of colour blindness a temporary ability to see colour when they use the glasses?
So I haven't tried the glasses. From what I understand, what they can do is help to emphasise the differences between certain colours. They don't, as it were, give you quote-unquote normal vision.
Yeah.
But you can get specific versions that help to emphasise the differences. But that's still quite limited as far as I understand. I do have in the accessibility settings on my phone, for example, and many of your listeners may have this as well, there is a setting which again will emphasize the contrast, say for example, between the buttons for YouTube versus WhatsApp. So they're red and green, but when I turn that setting on, one looks black and the other looks kind of gray. So it emphasizes that difference. So those are the sorts of things, in terms of the software on the phone, I imagine it's pretty straightforward for them to implement, but it can make a huge difference. At the same time, it doesn't sort of cure it, as it were. The colours still look kind of weird.
I'm probably going to go out on a limb and feel that you don't think you have anything of which you can or should be cured.
Right. I mean, I muddle along perfectly well. The people I worry about, for example, are kids who don't realise, because, a child can't tell you what they're not seeing, as it were. And, then it might come to, let's say, a geography exam where they have to look at a coloured map, or if the teacher's using red and green markers on the whiteboard, and they might not be able to say exactly what's wrong, and they might just not get the marks for that question and never realise. So for me, I can cope perfectly well. I only have a mild form of colourblindness anyway, but the people I worry about are the kids who maybe haven't been diagnosed, and that's why I think awareness, on the one hand, and sort of early diagnosis is particularly important. I mean, I'm not asking for huge changes or making any grand demands, but I think it's kids that I do worry about.
Certainly food for thought. Joel Walmsley of the Department of Philosophy at UCC, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, a cap on rent increases of 2% could come into force as early as November. Housing Minister Dara O'Brien is pushing for the cap, which could be signed off on Cabinet in the coming weeks. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by John Mark McCafferty, Chief Executive of Threshold. John Mark, you're welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Delighted to have you. I imagine a cap is welcome, but philosophically this is very similar to the freeze on creche prices. It'll just hold them effectively where they are. It does nothing to make rents more affordable or increase people's sense of security in rented homes.
It doesn't bring the cost of rents down. It allows rents to continue to increase, but to, I suppose, a lower cap than has been the case up to now. The rent pressure zones were brought in at the end of 2016, and in the areas where they applied, the limit was 4% of an annual increase. So, I mean, bringing it down to 2% is better than it was. Mm. But I guess we're at a historic level of high, and even with COVID, we thought there might be a kind of a correction in the private rented sector. That didn't materialise. And in fact, the last quarterly rental report by the Residential Tenancies Board showed very, very significant wholesale increases in rents, especially outside of the Dublin area, places like Kildare and other commuter counties. And so the affordability element of this is really, really important, because people's incomes aren't increasing to anywhere near the same rate as rents have increased over the last 7 years.
And interestingly, rents have increased in Kildare. I think they're up just below the double digits, which is 2.5 times the rate of inflation. So even were salaries keeping pace with inflation, they would still be markedly unaffordable. And the only thing, John, that's going to resolve this in the short, medium or long term is greater supply, which is something successive governments have been saying really since I began in this career some 20 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, like, I suppose there's a couple of things around kind of housing, and essentially, housing, the government stopped building houses in a meaningful way back in the late 1980s during the kind of financial crisis then. It's very slowly picked up in terms of, say, funding for social housing in the kind of mid-noughties, at the later part of the Celtic Tiger, by which case there was huge demand, a growing population, and that demand massively outstripping the supply of social housing. And then before we knew it, we're back into a very, very deep recession that we all know about. So we're now only building up from that again. And even in the construction sector, what was being built, say, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, it was more in the line of, say, hotels and offices. And only in the last number of years, housing really started to build up a pace with, say, the larger housing associations building and acquiring housing. Then COVID happened. So we've had so many barriers to the provision of supply of, say, social housing. Thing to welcome, although the numbers are quite low, is the commitment to cost rental. And that is coming on stream through the provision of more affordable rental accommodation and housing, apartments and houses, by the approved housing bodies, by the housing associations, which is a positive, but it's a drop in the ocean when you think of the number of people in the private rented sector and the level of demand.
Does cost rental not mean that though that there is a pre-agreed reduction on the rent for a property based at the market level?
Yeah, there's usually kind of a reduction of maybe say 25% or 30%. So there are kind of financial models behind it to try and ensure that the housing association isn't out of pocket by building them, but that at the same time they are, if you like, affordable to the tenant as well, or at least a lot more affordable than say the market price, and that. If you like, it's almost like a new housing tenure in the market. It is within the private rented sector, but it's very much an intervention by government to say, okay, we're going to provide these blocks or these houses. They will be at a reduced rate. And I suppose we have had various waves of affordable house purchase. So in a sense, this is the equivalent, but for rented accommodation, so that you don't own the house or the apartment, but you are paying a more affordable rent than say is available elsewhere in the market, and that supply will should help, but it won't necessarily reduce rents, because we know back in 2005 through to 2007 there was massive surges in the amount of overall housing supply, but rents and house prices continue to climb, so there's that to kind of consider. And I think also, if you add to that then the quality within the private rented sector, generally speaking, that you'll find more cold, damp homes in the private rented sector than you will in either the owner-occupied sector or indeed social housing. And the people who occupy those homes actually aren't really allowed to and often won't have the resources anyway to make any substantial improvements in the thermal efficiency of those homes.
Or put up a picture on the wall.
Yeah, or indeed hang a picture. They'll need permission by the landlord, who may or may not grant that permission. And I guess that comes down to this whole notion that, yes, it's a landlord's property, but it's a tenant's home. And that balance is a delicate balance to strike, but we know that government is committing that all private rented dwellings will have a certain minimum building energy rating below which they can't let the property, and that's coming in around the corner. That's 2025 when that comes in, so there's only really 5 years before that's a reality. 3 years before that's a reality, and a lot of stuff has to happen for that to be realised, for example, supports and maybe tax measures, because otherwise you'll have a situation where lots of rented housing may not be available because it doesn't reach those levels, given that so many are in the D, E, F category.
John Mark McCafferty, Chief Executive of Threshold, thank you indeed for joining us. I'm joined on the line now by Dr. Anne Nolan. She's an Associate Research Professor at the ESRI. Anne, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
You've just released what I feel is a very interesting study. It looked at the effect of road traffic noise on the cognitive function of older adults. Why was this the topic of your research in the first instance?
Well, we started to look at this because there's a lot of, concern about the environment around us and the effects on our health. So we all know that over the last 18 months or so, we're much more attuned to what's happening around our homes because we've spent so much time there. So, and there's a lot of, there's a lot of research and a lot of questions around different types of pollution. So whether that's air pollution or noise pollution and how that affects health. And one question that's particularly important is for older people. There's not a lot of evidence out there on the effects of noise pollution, for example, whereas there's a lot of evidence, for example, that noise pollution is really damaging for young children in terms of their cognitive function. So what we did in this study was we looked at people who were living in Dublin and Cork, who were over the age of 50, and we looked at road traffic noise around where they lived, and how that affected various sort of measures of their cognitive function. So cognitive function is things like memory, it's things like sort of processing speed, and sort of general sort of organisation of your thoughts and your words. And we looked at that using data from the Irish Longitudinal Study on Ageing, which people are probably familiar with.
And I would imagine on a really, really low level, virtually everybody will be familiar with, if you're driving somewhere unfamiliar and you're trying to discern the route and maybe your Google Maps isn't functioning, in order to concentrate more properly, you'll turn down the radio if it's playing so that your brain is free of that extra distraction. So I can only imagine the impact of a constant low level but high volume noise on the impact of cognitive ability of anybody generally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so there's, I suppose you've really hit the nail on the head as, you know, how this affects our cognitive ability. And I suppose one other aspect is that it's, you know, it's stressful listening to lots of noise and sort of concurrent noise and noise that lasts for a long time. So I suppose that's how this sort of affects people's cognitive abilities. But what we found actually was that people who were exposed to the highest levels of noise, and this was particularly noise at night, they had lower cognition on one particular measure, which was executive function. And I suppose executive function is, you know, it's not just, for example, this was a test of how many animals you could name in a minute. So it's not just a test of sort of verbal fluency, but yeah, you also have to do a little bit of organization. So you might think, okay, have I said that animal before? I might have to think about zoo animals, you know, farmyard animals, animals in Ireland, you know, animals outside Ireland. So there's a bit of organization in your thinking. And we found that noise was associated with performance on that test. I suppose it's worth saying as well, though, that, you know, obviously we're looking here at road traffic noise. And it's really hard to disentangle the effect of the noise from, I suppose, the air pollution that's also associated with road traffic. I suppose that's one thing that we'd like to investigate further is, I suppose, whether these effects that we're seeing on cognition are due to the noise or whether they're due to air pollution, because we know that obviously air pollution is really damaging to health as well.
Or whether those effects are on executive function are permanent, because I would imagine there might be a scenario whereby if the person goes on holiday for 2 weeks or leaves that noise or that environment for a defined period of time, if in fact it is the effect of the environment upon their executive function, that effect should in theory mitigate.
That's right. Yeah. So I suppose what we're looking at is this was just measured around 2013, 2014. But obviously we don't know where people, I suppose, grew up, where they spent most of their lives and whether they were exposed to high noise levels right through their lives. And similarly, I suppose, whether, you know, if you followed people in Tilda right up to the present day, whether, you know, there are people who were exposed to high levels of noise, I suppose their cognitive function declined even further over time. So, you know, there's still lots of, I suppose, unanswered questions here. But, you know, for the moment, this was an association at a single point in time.
Well, Dr. Anne Nolan, Associate Research Professor at the ESRI, thank you indeed for joining us. Certainly fascinating research there.